Campus FM presents a talk organized by the University Chaplaincy entitled Religious Beliefs and Attitudes of Maltese University Students. This talk is delivered by Professor Dirk Hutzbout.
Fortunate to have with us Professor Dirk Hutzbout from the University of Leuven in Belgium with us this morning. We thank him for having accepted the invitation of the chaplaincy of the university to be the main speaker at this seminar. He developed the post-critical belief scale, one of the elements used in the study, in order to gauge the respondents' religiosity. Professor Hutzbout was born on the 24th of March 1943 near Antwerp in a family with 8 children. Between 1961 and 1970, he studied at the Catholic University in Leuven, where he graduated as Master in Philosophy and Master in Psychology, and in between he did a year of military service. From 1970 to 1976, he was assistant to Professor A. Vergott, and in 1976 he defended his PhD thesis on belief as a lived relationship, religious attitude seen as a relational pattern to God. From 1976 to 1986, Dirk was a lecturer and assistant professor at the Faculty of Psychology and Educational Sciences in Leuven, teaching development psychology of religion in the Faculty of Theology. From 1986 till 2003, he was a full professor teaching psychology of religion, developmental psychology of religion, and methodology of research in religion. His students came from the Faculty of Psychology, Theology, Philosophy, and Anthropology. He is also the director of the Center for the Psychology of Religion. In 1971, he married Ludger Tricot, also a psychologist, and they have 2 sons, David and Just, and 1 daughter, Barbara, and they have 5 grandchildren. This morning, Professor Hutzbout will initially discuss the rationale of using this research method, and after he will give us his interpretation on the results of the survey, also comparing them to those of other countries. Professor Hutzbout.
Thank you very much. So you know more or less everything of me. In the first moment, I will say something, why we constructed that new scale, that PCBS. It works?
You don't need.
I don't need. Okay. So why we constructed? The reason is, in fact, that we have observed in the Belgian situation, when I speak of Belgium, I mean the Flemish situation. You know, Belgium is a very complex country. The northern part is speaking Dutch or Flemish. The southern part is speaking French. And we have a little part speaking German. We have more ministers than you. We have 5 or 6 governments, and it's a very complex affair. So we have seen, and I will give later on some details about that, that classic, well-known instruments of measuring religiosity were no longer working in our context because of a very fundamental secularization, and I will give only one number a little bit later on. For example, we have seen very clearly, when I worked in 76 on my PhD, religious attitude as a kind of relational pattern to God, on that moment it works. We could make some distinctions between groups and subgroups and so on and so on. We have seen later on, let's say certainly from the beginning of the 90s, that these instruments were no longer working. One of the basic reasons is, I say at first, process of secularization, and secondly, I could add to that the presence of unbelief. Until that moment, unbelief was in fact low in belief. I refer to the scale of Glockenstark. You have the different Catholic thoughts, Catholic contents of belief. You could imagine, let's say, a kind of examination in 20 questions. 20 questions where you can give a believing answer, yes, or you can say an unbelieving answer, no. The basic question that moment is, you are a believer. And that's very complicated. If you have more, perhaps, it's only my idea, if you have more than 10 to 20 or 12 to 20. If you have 18, you are a very strong believer. But the problem is, if you have lower than 10, you failed, you can say, on that kind of examination, Could you be considered as an unbeliever? So the problem is that unbelievers could only express their unbelief in saying no to religious questions. And I think that there is a basic difference, a fundamental psychological structure difference between belief and unbelief. So unbelief has his own perspective, his own way of thinking. So we need something new. And that new was that PCBS, that post-critical belief scale. And I can say a little bit proud that now at the moment this scale is applicated in at least 15 or 18 countries in Europe and outside countries. 1 week ago, I received an article of Tehran, Iranian students answering that questionnaire. Of course, they have translated a little bit to Islam context, and it works also there. Now, I will give at first, in the first moment, I will give some more information about the scale, and then I will make some remarks about the research they have done here, okay? First time, I refer, and that's perhaps the easiest thing to think, what's the basic problematic of that post-critical belief scale? Oh, the basic thing is, I refer to the story in the Gospel of Mark, Jesus walking on the water. So in fact, this scale tries to understand how people interact if they are confronted with an element of the religious tradition. And that element of the religious tradition can be everything. It can be a story out of the Gospel. But it can also be a talk of the Pope, or it can be a visit of a church, for example, or it can be the confrontation with the sacrament. So every time people are reacting to that element, are interacting with it on a very conscious level and perhaps also on a very subconscious level, but they are interacting with it. I think that religious indifference, absolute religious indifference, doesn't exist. Every time again, people will react, certainly if they are confronted with an element that's very important for them. So think about the story in Mark, the Gospel of Mark, you say, about Jesus walking on the water. Then you can have reactions, very different reactions. And I will say at first, every reaction is underlying, inspired by what we call inclusion of transcendence or exclusion of transcendence. You can translate that, let's say, a belief aspect or an unbelief aspect. So you start from the idea, implicitly or explicitly, that there is something more. You can say something transcendent, something we don't understand on the third level. Or you start from the idea that it's not the case, that you're excluding that possibility. That's the first dimension. Second dimension, literal and symbolic thinking. What I mean by literal thinking, I will be very short about that, is in fact that the story of the Bible, I refer to that story of the Bible, Jesus walking on the water, is an historical event, is a fact. Something happened really. And if you don't understand it, you can believe it. But it happened like is described in the Gospel. Jesus really walked on the water. That is what I call a literal interpretation. If you believe that Jesus walked on the water, really, that the story is a factual affair, then you are literal affirmation, or what I called in the beginning, orthodoxy. A second possibility is, and it's also literal, that you don't believe it. That you say, from the viewpoint of positive science, that's not possible, walking on the water. Try it. Prove me that you can do it. And I think, also in Malta, on the sea here, it's rather difficult to walk on the water. So in fact, you're rejecting that idea, exclusion of transcendency, because it's positively, from a positive scientific view, it is not possible. Everything had to be proven. So important is that these people, believers, orthodoxy, unbelievers, external critique, are in fact thinking literally. That means fundamentally, and that I think it's important, that there are, of course, differences between literal affirmation and literal disaffirmation. That's clear. The one is believer, the other one is unbeliever. But at the same time, there are similarities between the two. They are thinking both on a literal style. I give one example, and I explain that in my talk this afternoon more extensively. One of the basic problems in psychology of religion and sociology of religion is the fact that some views on religiosity, certainly literal, orthodox views on religiosity, are related to ethnocentricity. And that's a paradox. That means that the believer, if he is a literal believer, if he takes the stories of the Bible as facts, that in fact there is a tendency to be ethnocentric. That means to have negative feelings against other religions, other cultures, and other people. And that's a paradox. Which is, I think, I'm not a theologian, I think that one of the basic elements of the Christian tradition, of the gospel, is to be open for other cultures, open for other people, lenient to other people. But we see in many studies, hundreds of studies, that these people have a tendency to be ethnocentric. I don't say, ladies and gentlemen, that all believers are ethnocentric. I say only that there is a tendency to be ethnocentric. The same thing, and that's important, is the case for literal unbelievers. Also, literal unbelievers have a tendency to be ethnocentric. The tendency is lower, but it exists. And I refer to September 11. You know, the next day in the journal, all the journals in Europe, and I think also here in Malta, certainly in Belgium, were given the fact that religion gives rise to this kind of atrocities. It was the cause was religiosity, religion, belief systems. I don't think it's true. It's literal thinking, or in the form of belief, or in the form of unbelief, will give rise to ethnocentricity. So not belief on the first level, but literal thinking on the first level. That's important. With believers, the tendency is higher. With unbelievers, the tendency is a little bit lower. And that's related, I think, to the fact that believers are making a group, a church, you can say. That's not the case with unbelief. We don't have the church of unbelievers. And we know from social psychology that if you belong to a group, and to give a very strange example, men and women, for example, that if you are belonging to a group, there is a tendency, every time again, to have negative feelings to the other group. So your feelings are more positive to your in-group, the group where you belong to, and there is a kind of tendency to have negative feelings to the other group. Men are not always so friendly to women, and perhaps also women are not always so friendly to men. And you can give examples in the time, the Russians to the Americans, the Jews to other people, etc., etc. Oh, okay, so first thing, what I mean now by symbolic belief, or symbolic interpretation, symbolic interpretation. That means that people must make a distinction, a very fundamental distinction, between what I call the manifest story, the story as such, Jesus walked on the water, and what I call the latent meaning, the underlying meaning of the story. That means, what's the meaning of that story? Fundamental is now that if you take a symbolic interpretation, that at least different interpretations are possible. Different meanings are possible. That means if you are referring to Jesus walked on the water, you ask yourself the question, what's now the meaning? What could be the meaning of that story? And if you are looking to the underlying meaning, you will find some similarities with your own stories. I give another example. Moses walked with his people 40 years to the desert. I don't know if there is a desert in Malta. I don't think so. And in Belgium, certainly, there's no desert. Many water and many ways and many costs, too much costs. But okay, what's now the meaning of that story? You can say, I don't have an experience with the desert. But we understand more or less which kinds of feelings, which kinds of emotions, which kinds of thoughts are coming up when I think about a desert. You can say everyone in his personal life could pass through a little desert. That means at a certain moment you have a feeling of depression. You feel yourself not happy. You feel yourself a little bit uneasy with the situation. So on that moment, telling the story of Moses with his people through the desert has a meaning for you because you are interpreting it. So symbolic means you are interpreting. And fundamentally, I repeat, is the fact that fundamentally different interpretations are possible. They are a little bit linked to your individual story, linked to your culture, to your population, etc., etc. So different interpretations. Now also, we have two ways of thinking, an unbelieving and a believing. I will refer on that later on. What's now what I call relativism? Relativism are in fact people who find it interesting, this kind of stories. For example, they see that not only in the Christian tradition, but also in other traditions, similar stories are present. So it means that in different religious traditions, people are using stories to say something fundamental about love, about the origin of life, about death, about life after death, etc., etc. We can only tell something about these fundamental events when we are telling stories to each other. So, and relativists are very interested by these different stories, by the similarities and dissimilarities with the different religious traditions and different religious stories. But fundamental, and in function of that, we put them on the side of unbelief, exclusion of transcendency. I can say it, it's not their cup of tea. They are not committing themselves. It's interesting to read. Many of these people know a lot of things about different religious traditions, about Buddhism and Hinduism and Protestantism and Catholicism and all kinds of formations, etc., etc. But it's not their cup of tea. They are not committing themselves. It remains a little bit outside. Okay. What's now second naivete? Second naivete means that we can live with the stories because we interpret them. I give the example, I don't know here in Malta, do you know St. Nicholas on December 6th? Do children receive presents? No? Another way then, they receive presents in Malta, of course. Eh? Okay, in Belgium on the 6th of December, and the holy man comes on a white horse over the roofs and put the presents in the chimney. And because of that, he has a black helper. Because the helper has to put the presents through the chimney in your living room. We know, I hope so, that this is not the case. That in fact, it are simply the parents who are putting late in the evening the presents before the chimney, and at the morning they tell the story. That's very important now. We know the story. We know that in fact the reality is a little bit different. That the holy man is not coming on a white horse over the roofs, we know. But at the same time, we tell the same story to our children. My children are old enough, 35. I will tell the story to my grandchildren without having negative feelings, knowing that's a story, in order to tell something, namely that we take the occasion of the holy the man to give some presents to the children. That is what I call second naivete. That means we can use the stories of the Bible, Jesus walked on the water, or other stories of the Bible, many interesting stories of the Bible, knowing, being aware of the fact, because we were going through a kind of critical period, that in fact these stories are not directly related to facts. That these stories are in fact stories in order to give a message, to tell something about the fundamental question. That is what I'll call second naivete. First naivete is very simple. It's the understanding of a child. He's the first naivete. He really believes that St. Nicholas is coming through the chimney. I will tell a story of our first rector in Leuven, Professor de Zomer. You know, we have splitting up the university in Leuven in a Dutch-speaking and a French-speaking part. And the French-speaking was saying that they are expulsed from Leuven. It's a little bit true. Rector de Zomer was a man of medical science, a very clever man, very intelligent man. He doesn't like to tell the story of St. Nicholas to his children because he has the idea you have to inform children objectively, not telling this kind of strange stories. The reality is that his children didn't believe him. Because in that moment, the only way for little children to understand what's going on, St. Nicholas, was just a story. That's important. So tell stories to your children. Okay, that's the model. Now, in fact, you can analyze the model. I'm too long, no? We can analyze the model from different perspectives. Or you analyze the data in function of belief and unbelief. Or you analyze the data in function of literal and symbolic thinking. Or you analyze the data in function of the four quadrants. I say two words again. I said ethnocentricity is related to literal thinking. A little bit more believers than unbelievers. Ethnocentricity is not related to symbolic thinking. So if people are thinking concerning their religiosity, their belief system, in a symbolic way, there is no direct opening to ethnocentricity. That is one of my arguments, there are other ones, why I call restorative interpretation or second naivete more mature than little thinking. Because there is a possibility to exclude or to interact excluding ethnocentricity. And I think we agree that ethnocentricity is, let's say, a paradox, is in opposition with the Christian message, with the Christian tradition. Okay. So that was my first little explanation about the model. Now, perhaps in a second moment, I will react on some elements of the research. I will not mention everything, of course, a little bit related to what Paul was saying. My first remark is, and I will compare a little bit with the study we have done in Leuven, that there is more prayer than religious practice. That's interesting. That means, and that's also the case in Leuven. We have done a big study, we are asking the students if they pray, how they pray, and when they pray. And if they go to church, if they are religious, etc. It's very clear that students are much more praying than going to church. And if we ask them, where do you pray? That's remarkable that one of the places where they never pray is the church. So if they pray, they pray at night before sleeping. And someone was adding, sorry, I pray only when I am alone. So they pray at night in their bed before sleeping. Fundamental is, and I think that could be a suggestion for the next research, to scrutinize more or less what's now the meaning of praying. Let's say from a Catholic tradition, you have the idea that praying is always religious in the institutional aspects of religion, related to God, related to the church, related to the Holy Virgin, etc., etc. I think also in Malta it will not be the case. So people are calling prayer very different things. For example, thinking about my day is also called by students prayer. So it's interesting to see there is another aspect when you are asking questions about institutional aspects or if you're asking questions about more personal aspects. And I think prayer is one of the most personal aspects of the person. So it could be an interesting suggestion. Okay, that's the first thing. The second thing is religious practice. I have said to Paul Galea and to other people that I was very surprised by your numbers of religious practice. I started my research career, like it was said here, in 1970. On that moment, when I was doing research in Belgium, in the Flanders, always in the Flanders, in Catholic schools, 75% of the population in the Flanders are going to Catholic schools. So in 1970, so more or less 40 years ago, when I asked that question, 95 at 12 years, 13 years, to 85 at 18 years were saying to me that they were going to church every Sunday. So on that moment, religious practice in Catholic schools was an absolute dominant behavior. It was out of the question that you were not going to church. When I asked the same question 40 years later, I see 6 to 7%. So we have a decrease, a terrible decrease in religious practice in the Flanders. The Flanders was known, like Ireland and like Poland, as internationally, in sociological literature, as a paradigm of a Catholic country. If you are going to a Catholic country, go to Poland, to Dublin, or to Belgium, the northern part. The southern part, the Walloons, were always less religious. So that's a terrible switch. 1970, and later on. So we have seen a decrease fundamentally during the last 40 years. Cool. So it's interesting. In fact, in the Flanders, I was educated, like was said, in a large family, we are living what I call under a conceptual Catholic, umbrella. Sorry for the word, I was looking. So there was a Catholic umbrella. If you are going to school, you are going to Catholic school. If you are going to a yacht movement, it was a Catholic yacht movement. If you have, assurance company, it was a Catholic assurance company. If you are going on holidays with a club, it was a Catholic club, etc., etc., etc. You're reading Catholic journals and Catholic magazines, etc., etc. So it was a kind of Catholic umbrella. It's very difficult to say when that umbrella, was finished. I think, but it's an hypothesis. There was never done research about that, that I think Humanae Vitae was a very important event. So the problem Paul VI about anticonception, hey, you know, the famous thing about the chemical anticonception. On that moment, many people in the Flanders, young couples, Catholic couples, educated under that Catholic umbrella, have said, no longer. I will be Catholic, but that's my private affair. I think on that moment, one of the stones of that Catholic umbrella, of that Catholic building, was taken out. And later on, people were becoming aware of the fact that it was possible to call yourselves Christian or Catholic without participating in everything. I can give an example. Not going to Mass on Sunday, when I was adolescent, was absolutely unthinkable. You were going to church. I will tell you very shortly, I have 5 minutes, very short story. In 1958, we had a big exposition in Brussels, international exposition in Brussels, and on a Sunday, it was allowed from my mother that I would go with a French maid for me to the exposition, from Antwerp to Brussels, with a train ticket. But I had to promise to my mother that we had to go to church on the exposition. There was a big church, the Vatican church. Okay. We were coming into the Mass, and it was just after the preaching. And you know that your Mass is valid if you are just in the beginning until the end. So we were, in fact, 3 minutes too late. So we had not the valid Mass. After the end of the Mass, and every half an hour we had a new Mass. It was ring after half an hour. I said to Georges Mailleux, my French mate, coming to us to learn Dutch, I said, "Georges, I think it's okay." And Georges said, "No, no, Dirk, it's not okay." So we stayed until the next Mass, until the same moment we were coming in. So we have linked the two Masses together, and we had the feeling, okay, we had a valid Mass. So I give that a little bit strange example to see how I was educated, but also how we were thinking on that moment. That was a way of thinking. If I ask now that question of validity of the Mass to young people, they will make very strange remarks, I think. So that is important to say. In a second level, I say, in fact, on that moment, we were not educated in faith, because faith was an understanding. It was normal. It was okay. Everyone was Catholic or Christian. We were educated in church commitment. So that's a very fundamental difference. Never there was discussions about faith, being unbeliever. It was unthinkable. We were educated in church commitment. We know what to do in the church, in the situation of the church. And in fact, the question of faith was in fact a rather unimportant question, because there was an understanding that everyone was a faithful person. Okay. Third remark about the morality. It's clear that there is a difference between what people are saying and what people are doing. And you are a little bit astonished by that. Now, I think from psychology in general, that's a very fundamental affair. You have to make a distinction between what I call attitudes, what people think and say what I think, and behavior. And ladies and gentlemen, there is a very fundamental difference between attitudes and behavior. And the basic difference is that attitude is not circumstantial, has nothing to do with concrete circumstances. I could interview you now on all kinds of attitudes, on the moment. But we can observe not only one very specific behavior, namely the fact that you're sitting down and listening to me. So a behavior is very concrete, has to do with circumstances, is much more influenced by concrete circumstances than by attitudes. In fact, and that's a little bit perhaps too hard, in many studies, we don't see any relation, any correlation between attitudes and behavior. So the relation is in fact zero. That means when it's zero, it's not negative, I say it's zero. That means fundamentally, for some people, there is a relation between attitudes and behavior. They behave as they feel and say. Other people are doing just the opposite thing, are doing just the other thing than what they have said that they will do. And for some people, it's otherwise. So that means if you are putting all this together, some people with a positive relation between attitudes and behavior, and you put them together with people with a negative relation between attitudes and behavior, the two are in fact unrelated to each other. That's very important to think. So I think it's a little bit of an illusion that you can change behaviors in changing at first attitudes. I give an example from the United States. You know, in the 50s, there was a big problem in the southern states of the United States to put black and white children together in the same school, or more than that, in the same bus. So they had to urge the people to put the children in the same bus, black and white children. And it is in function of that behavior that attitudes were changed. So people have the awareness, the experience, you can say, that it is possible to be together with black children in the same bus. Sorry for the expression, they don't smell. In the beginning, white children were thinking they smell ugly. But if you are together in the same bus, you have the concrete experience, they don't smell. So, in fact, you change your attitude in function of changing behavior. So you have to work on behaviors very concretely, and in function of that, people will change their attitudes. That's a very important thing. So, okay, now, a second remark concerning that morality, Paul Pola said the same thing. You have fixed in that research on sexual morals. I think, and he remembered that also, there is a difference also in the results if these attitudes are far away from my personal life or very near to my personal life. You see very clearly that they are much stronger, you can say, in things far away, abortion, euthanasia, and this kind of things. But they are much more lenient if it goes to very concrete behaviors. That's also an important thing. We have observed just the same thing in a study in Leuven, but we had added also other aspects of morality. Between believers and unbelievers, rather similar to churchgoers and not churchgoers, is very similar. We see very clearly in Leuven that, in fact, there is no difference concerning all kinds of ethical behavior, social behavior, interaction behavior, and this kind of things, between believers and unbelievers. It's only concerning the aspects, sexual aspects, euthanasia, abortion, this kind of things. So that makes the difference between believers and unbelievers, just the same thing as here. And it has to be clear, in Belgium is abortion and euthanasia allowed in certain circumstances since 7 years, I think now, 6 years, and that was a big trouble, a big discussion about, let's say, believers and unbelievers, just that problem. But I think you have to be careful in interpreting that. So be careful, attitude and behavior is different. Okay. Concerning that scale, you have seen very clearly, it was also shown, that in fact, second naivete and orthodoxy are higher for believers or churchgoers and lower for not churchgoers, just the same thing, vice versa, external critique and relativism. That's, of course, a good sign of validity of the scale. It would be very strange if churchgoers were lower than not churchgoers. That's clear. But my fundamental point is now, and that's a little bit complicated, and in fact, on that moment, I don't have an answer, so it's clear. In Malta, we see very clearly second naivete is higher than relativism, than external critique, and than orthodoxy. So it means churchgoers, or you can say believers, are believing on a symbolic way as what I call second naivete. Relativism is also very present. It's interesting. I will come back, return that in 2 minutes. External critique is low and orthodoxy is also low. Interesting is orthodoxy doesn't make a difference between churchgoers and non-churchgoers. I think, I was a little bit surprised by that. I think that one of the reasons could be that the scores are low from the beginning. You can go low, but it's different to go still lower. So that could be the reason. But I was a little bit surprised. But for the other dimensions, second naivete, external critique and relativism, you see in the good direction. Now, what's now the fundamental problem, I think, with relativism? We see very clearly in Belgium, in the Flanders, that relativism becomes, in the age period of, let's say, 16 to 22, 23, 24, the major dimension, the most important dimension. So that means, and we have data of more than 10,000 students, because the scale is on the internet, it's used many times in the beginning, at the age of 18, 19, 20, 21, in the beginning of a course of religion in Catholic schools. They ask the students to fill in on the internet the scale, they make a community, and then discuss their results. So in that moment, we have gathered, I think, 8,000 to 10,000 data. And we see very clearly that relativism is becoming the most important dimension. And on the second level, second naivete, relativism and orthodoxy are much lower. Now, the basic question is, what means relativism? And here, I'm hesitating. And my colleagues in theology are less hesitating than me, but I'm a hesitator. You can interpret, I think, relativism from a double perspective. Or it can be, and that's a little bit my tendency to interpret it such a way, as a kind of transitional period. not a definitive status. It can become a definitive status for some of them, but it can be a kind of intermediate transitional status in order to become, let's say, second naivete. I think it's interesting to note, and that's a little bit my idea, that these people are still interested in the religious field. They know something about that. They are interested. They read about that. And that, I think, is a positive sign. So it's a positive sign. They read, they think, they discuss. And you cannot predict, but you never know what will be the end of that process. I think on that moment, the end of the process can be double. Or they stay into relativism for the rest of their lives, or they can switch to another status, to a belief status in terms of second naivety. That's my interpretation, and perhaps a little bit my hope. I don't know. I'm hesitating. And I hope that the successors in my field, you know, I'm a retired man, that in fact they will try to organize research about that, to follow people. It's very difficult to follow people, but it could be interesting to follow people over some years and to see what's happening with people who are now very relativist, what's happening with them, let's say, 5 or 10 years later. Be careful about that, because making predictions, it's very difficult. I would hesitate. But I think on the moment that the two are still possible, or remaining into that relativism, or switching to second naivete. Other people who are more, let's say, my colleague in theology, a little bit more hesitating about that, a little bit anxious about that in fact it has to be a definitive status, namely a status of unbelief. I've said very clearly they are interested in religion, they read about that, they know much more perhaps than many other people who are very believers. And Didier Polofet said, I think it's a definitive status. They will remain relativist, that means they will never commit themselves. That's a basic difference between second naivete and relativism. Second naivete people are thinking symbolically, but are committing themselves. It becomes their cup of tea, you can say. Relativists are, in fact, not. It's not their cup of tea. Okay. But there I'm hesitant. I don't know. I don't know. Perhaps into 10 years we will know more or less what the right answer. I think in religious education there is a kind of fundamental option. Okay, no 5 minutes? Okay. There is a kind of fundamental option. Or we educate people to what I called a closed religious system. What does that mean? That means, in fact, that we organize such a way that people have an absolute certainty in belief. That we give a very clear and always the same message. That in fact reinforce always the same affairs, the same data, the same statements. That means that in fact you are using, between brackets, religion in order to overcome uncertainty. So we make a fundamental distinction between religiosity, give certainty, and uncertainty in life. Now I think, it's my hypothesis, that on that moment you are in fact guiding people to a kind of orthodox or literal thinking with some negative affairs. For example, literal thinkings have problems with ambiguity, are avoiding questions. Don't ask questions about that, otherwise I will be disturbed. Give me the right answer. And they are starting from the idea, and I repeat, I'm not a theologian, that on every theological question there is only one answer, the so-called right answer. My experience is, sorry for theologians, if you ask a question to theologians, you start with a discussion of 7 hours. Certainly if you have different theological options. So I think also theologians are not so clear in their answer, but of course some theologians can give the same answer every time the same, giving the impression to the people that there is only one answer to that specific question. And I think, but perhaps that's not a theological expression, that there are certainly at least 2 answers on every religious question, and perhaps much more than 2. So, second element, so you organize a closed system. You give always the same answer. Also, you give the idea to the people that the answers given to religious questions are always the same since 2000 years until now. that in fact there is no evolution in religious thinking. And my stupid argument against that, and it's a very stupid, very pragmatical and positivistic argument, is in fact, go to a library of theology. There are thousands, there are one in the theology library of Leuven, we have 1 million books. So that gives me, I didn't read them all, of course not. 1 million books. So that means fundamentally, very pragmatically, that there are at least different answers to the same question. And I think it's very important that this answer will evolve over the time. And I refer to a Flemish professor, one of the greatest theologians of modern time, Schillebeek. Schillebeek says every time, he's very old now and I think very sick, Schillebeek said always, every answer on the religious question is in fact an historical answer. And that means fundamentally a kind of relativism is implied. So I think that's very important. If you organize, you want to organize an open system that you give to the students or to the people, the idea that that is on this moment an answer, perhaps my answer, of the answer of this community, implying fundamentally that it is only one possible answer. That means that you give an openness to other answers. So I think that's a very fundamental choice, open or closed system. And we have done some research about that. We see very clearly that if people have an open system, that in fact their religious belief, their religious system, is much more integrated in their life development than if you give a closed system. A closed system means, and that you can do on the level of belief and unbelief. Belief means orthodoxy, the same answer always again, unchangeable, etc., etc. But you can have just the same thing with unbelief. That means that the only good answer to every question is a positive one, positive scientific one. In fact, people are using religiosity, belief you can say, or unbelief, in trying to overcome uncertainty. And I think, certainly in our modern culture, that's a very fundamental training to help people to live and to experience uncertainty, ambiguity. That in fact there are no so clear answers to this kind of questions, and every time again we had to reinvent answers in function of cultures, etc., etc. So belief is a possibility, but also unbelief is a possibility, and that I think is a very fundamental target, to see that the two are possible in modern culture, in modern society, and we have seen that very clearly in the Flanders. I said, I repeat, and I finish with that, the Flanders was known as a paradigm of a Catholic country, so living under that Catholic umbrella, and in fact, unbelief was very exceptional. In my class, in last year of secondary school, when we were 18 years, in my class, I was on a Jesuit college, very severe, ladies and gentlemen, very severe, these Jesuits. Now it's lower. They are not so long, so severe. But in my time, they were very severe. In my class, there was one boy. It was, of course, only boys in that school. One boy not going to Mass. And we found that very strange. It was, in fact, a pagan. We had one pagan in our class. So many years later, perhaps in the same class of the last year of humanities in college, high school, perhaps there is one or two going to Mass. That's the basic switch we have experienced in Belgium, in the Flanders, let's say, in the last 40, 50 years. From one pagan, and I exaggerate a little bit, to one Catholic. Thanks. You can ask questions.
Thank you very much, Professor Tubbel, for a very stimulating expose of the results, also with the various comparisons between Malta and Flanders. We now open the floor to questions, observations, and we invite you to put your own questions or comments to either of the speakers. If you could identify your name, please.
I know that the first question is always the most difficult one. So we go directly to the second one.
The second question. Mr. Rattard.
Two questions. First of all, thanks for this very revealing survey. It's indicative of the situation we're passing through and the changes that are affecting our young people. Have you, in the survey, distinguished between the different faculties? I'm particularly interested in the way those who are following a BEduc course have responded to the survey, particularly primary education students, because they'll be teaching students religion as well. That's point number one. And point number two, do you give any value or any interpretation on those who did not actually answer the survey? That means about 421 answered out of 600, roughly about 70%. Do you give any value and interpretation to those who did not actually answer the survey? Were they students who weren't even interested in such things as religion? What would be their impact on the result if we were to take these into consideration?
As regards the first question, we have not done that exercise, although that would be an interesting step to do with statistically discriminating now not only between churchgoers and non-churchgoers, but between faculties. That can be done, obviously, and it would be interesting also to see whether there's any difference, especially on this test, between science students and students of humanities that might be more revealing. That would be another step, a little bit of more sophistication in the elaboration of our data. That is possible, but we haven't done that. Now, as regards the other, this is a normal thing with people who are doing research that you don't expect to have a response, a total response from the sample you have originally thought to get. So that is the 400, I mean, almost two-thirds of responses is a very good one, with a little bit of stimulation from those who were distributing and collecting the data. From a scientific perspective, that did not change the picture a lot because, averages then start to gel, and no matter how much numbers you put into them, the picture is not going to change from a statistical perspective. So the interpretation, what about the people who were left out of the survey, that is those who did not respond? My hunch is that they are not very different from those who had responded, and there could be thousands of reasons why they could have not responded or forgotten or lost the questionnaire or were not interested, they're too busy. So that's very difficult to tell.
I can perhaps something, the experience we had in Leuven about that, we did the same thing some years ago. In Leuven we have seen very clearly that, of course, we don't have religious indices, but we have to, if we are looking to faculties, to age groups, men and women, so there was no difference. So in fact, the group not answering was regarding the university parameters, the year, the faculty, etc., were in fact no difference. But I estimate a little bit here, and perhaps also in Leuven, that people not answering, there is a kind of pre-selection. And it could be that, in fact, the people not answering, in fact, were less religious than the people answering. Certainly, and that's only suggestion. It's not a critique, you know. It's only suggestion. I think it's important to know who has asked the questions. And here is the chaplaincy. So, in fact, you can say the religious institution at the university. And I think that people have a kind of interaction with who is asking the questions. And there is a kind of social desirability in a certain sense. You can say, perhaps I give a little bit another answer if it's the question is asked by the chaplaincy or, for example, the question is asked by the faculty of psychology or sociology. So it's only a little suggestion that if you want to do that the next time, that the sender of the message would be as neutral as possible. But in fact, we don't know if that plays a role. In Leuven, we have seen the group not answering was very similar concerning faculty, etc., than the group who has answered. Concerning difference between faculties, in Leuven, yes. Positive science was and medicine was a little bit more religious on different indices than human science. And the most profane faculty, and that's not only in Leuven, but that's international, is psychology. And one of the most believing is educational science. And in Leuven, we are two departments in the same faculty. So that's, and that's international. So if you're perhaps now less than before, but internationally the psychologists are known as the most unbelieving group. Can I add something other very shortly? You have seen here, you have mentioned that difference between men and women. Always women, more religious, more church going, etc., more believing than men. It's very difficult to interpret that given fact. In fact, I think we don't have a theory, a real good theory, to interpret sex differences in religion. I've read tens of things about that. But always a little bit from that style, you know. I put my finger in the air and I will find something. But a real good theory, basically psychological theory about different men and women, we don't have. In Belgium, in the Flanders, we have seen that these differences are totally disappearing since more or less 75, 80, something like that. Before, yes, every time. Girls more Catholic, more religious, more believing, more going to mass, etc., than boys. Now, on the moment, in all the data we have gathered with the PCBS, and that's, I think, more or less 40,000 subjects, never we find differences. And in fact, I'm happy because we don't have a scheme for interpretation. Never. And so I don't know what that means. Really, I don't know. No. There are some very vague things, but no, I don't know.
One thing I could add in this line of thought is that the differences we found also is not only between men and women, but also between people living in Gozo and living in Malta, though there's only a few kilometers of distance. But it's not insignificant in the sense that Glock mentions those five dimensions, but there are others who mention a sixth dimension, which I did not include, but I think it's very important. I believe in it. Is the socio-cultural dimension.
Yeah.
Religion cannot be taken in isolation.
Yeah.
So we, it's implicit that we are living in a particular country where it's very Catholic, not necessarily very Christian, as they say. They used to say about the Catholic people of Rome, they are very good Catholics but bad Christians.
Yeah, that's true.
And in Gozo, we have a particular society which is very much imbued into traditions and a particular way of life, where living and relating to church or religious activities is one and very, very close. So you can see that this is being imported, and we can see this striking difference between these two different cultures or subcultures.
I agree totally. The cultural impact is very important, very, very important. For example, if I compare data or circumstances in the Flanders and the Netherlands, it's very different. For example, I give an example. I had an experience, I don't know, 10 years ago, I was in a meeting with professors and colleagues in Holland, also concerning research about university studies, who I did in Leuven and in Nijmegen. And at a certain moment, there was a woman telling, I had to go because I had to organize and to celebrate two marriages. Say, oh, two marriages. So she was playing the role as a priest in a so-called Catholic marriage in Holland. And they found it absolutely normal. That's in the Flanders unthinkable. Perhaps some women are dreaming about that. But practically, it's unthinkable that people would consider a marriage as a real Catholic marriage, let's say, with a female priest. So that's another way of thinking. And in that sense, I agree totally with Paul. I think the culture plays a very important role. And it's perhaps strange that I say that. I think that one of the reasons, the terrible decline in practice and in church commitment, is perhaps, it can sound very strange, that in fact in the Flanders we were too Catholic. And the dominance of Catholicism was very, very high. And we are still experiencing, let's say, the effects of that absolute dominance. Certainly in my age group, the younger people is finished, but in my age group, older guys, we see that there is still a kind of battle against a no longer existing church, you see? They are still thinking about the church as a very authoritarian, very dominant, etc., organization, and it's in fact no longer the case. But they are still fighting, in fact, against their own yacht and against their own education. And in that sense, I say perhaps we were too Catholic, And one effect is that we are now still battling against that high level of Catholicism, that have very high dominance of Catholicism. But that's a cultural affair.
Yeah, just one other thing that I stop here. No, but we have to keep in mind also that this survey was done among university students, which could be have a different culture from the students and youth of their age to outside. I have some other data, but coming from different studies which I am doing with the engaged couples, where one interesting element is when I ask them about their religious, you know, beliefs or rather church attendance, it's that there is more religiosity among the educated, those who have done tertiary education, and less religious practice among the unskilled laborers.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking about their contemporaries, I mean their same age, because these are people going for the marriage preparation courses. So it seems that this is an element of culture, maybe in terms of the relativism and symbolic interpretation. But so one eye opener is that the fact that so many people attend to churches, that there are so many people here who adhere to traditions, including the festas, that is not necessarily a sign of religious maturity. It could be more of a sign of orthodoxy. Mm-hmm. But when the situation changes, that might put them in a crisis.
Yeah, sure.
First of all, thank you very much. I'm Father John Vella. I work here as a counselor. I'm struck that we're talking about a phenomenon which we call religion, and mostly we're talking about scales and positivism. I was wondering if, because there are multiple layers of religion and also of interpretation, and I was wondering if this same survey is done in a qualitative way, I mean, using hermeneutics and all that, what would be the outcome, especially with multiple interpretations? That's maybe a very vast question.
If I understand your question very well, could we have other results with the qualitative?
If we had the same survey or whatever it is done in a qualitative method, what would be the outcome? If there is a correlation or not?
I will be honest. I'm an empiricist. I've always, not always, but many times worked with questionnaires. I'm a little bit hesitating if qualitative interviews, you mean, for example, qualitative data, would be so different than this data. I'm not so sure. Let's say this is fundamentally related with the construction process of a questionnaire. We have taken 5 years to do that in many different samples. Of course, perhaps you will have other things, but I think I will try to be clear. I think that qualitative research is much more difficult than this kind of research because you have the interaction process. And because of the fact that the interviewer will reinforce, perhaps on a very preconscious level, what the subject is saying. And if, for example, the subject is saying something, he agrees or it's fitting with his own way of thinking, he will reinforce. Without knowing, perhaps, that he reinforces in saying very simply, something like that. Or he will, let's say, punish in giving a kind of negative thing. So I think that this kind of scale research is perhaps more neutral. But I agree, and I don't think so, that if you are doing good qualitative research, that you will have very different things. We have done the same thing, where we have interviewed, and with the scale, but also with interview following the Fowler model, you know, Fowler, faith development model, with parents and their own sons and daughters. Ladies and gentlemen, to organize that, it's very difficult. The boys and the girls, it's not difficult. The mothers, it's not difficult, but the fathers. To convince the fathers to do an interview, it's terribly complicated. So we interviewed boys and girls, 18 years old, and their parents, mothers and fathers. At first a questionnaire, and later on an interview. And then we see, for example, that in fact you're adding some very concrete things. I will give one or two examples. For example, you see, generally spoken, there is a high similarity between mothers and daughters and fathers and sons, and also vice versa. So that means in a family, there is a kind of systemic thinking, more or less on the same style. So if the father is unbeliever, also the sons and daughters will be more or less unbeliever. And vice versa. So there is a common style, you can say. But there are exceptions. And that, of course, is interesting with qualitative interviews. With this kind of with scales, you can't find the difference, the exceptions, because everything is mixed together. For example, we have seen very clearly that the son, I remember very well, a boy of 18 years old, I remember his name, he was John. He was very different from his father and his mother. He was a believer, very committed, very engaged, and his father's mother was, in fact, well, I don't believe that. It's all very strange stories, you know. And do you believe that yourself? This kind of remarks. What was now the reason? And that you cannot find in a kind of question research. This boy was, let's say, very attracted and guided by one of his teachers in the school. So he was, in fact, becoming committed because his contact with one of his teachers, where he has a very high-level discussion that you can find in this. In that sense, I think that qualitative research is more difficult than this one, but give very interesting specificities. And I agree with you, if you do research on large samples, you miss the specificities. That's clear. You can add something. Open questions, yes, but be careful. It's very difficult to formulate them. And people, it asks a big engagement from people to give a clear and good elaborated answer on an open question. If it is very short, it brings nothing very new. But I agree with you, that's clear. In this kind of research, you miss some specificities. That's absolutely clear. And then perhaps you need some qualitative research. But be careful how you will select your subjects. There also, you have to be very careful, because you could select your subject in function of your hypothesis. You see what I mean? Okay. Please.
And if you said that earlier on, you referred to the fact that the response to a survey from the source, who the source is, could create a certain amount of balance of bias in the response. Sure. When you're doing a qualitative, even more, because you have the added input of the interview.
Sure. I think you have to be very good trained to do very good qualitative research. And people have always the impression that it's more personal, it's more individual, it's more specific. I'm not so sure. Two words. In a research we did in Leuven on university students concerning the gut representation, we have asked two ways of questioning. At first, a questionnaire. I think, if I remember very well, 33 different gut representations. Items, questions. Chip, chip. You can answer yes, no, so. And an open question, what's the meaning of God for you? So they could give their private answer, their individual, so-called personal answer. On 1,472 subjects, if my memory is still well, but it begins to collapse my memory. In fact, if we combine with rather high-level statistical analysis, the two answer structures and the questionnaire and the open questions, they are fundamentally overlapping. So that I think the fundamental work, if you want to work with a questionnaire, is to take care of constructing your questionnaire. It takes more than 10 minutes. And some people are thinking, I will write some item, chip, 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 and I will start the questionnaire. No, it doesn't work such a way. That's a little bit the problem.
Professor Camilleri.
What concrete action does the church in general and the chaplains in particular plan to take on the results of this survey?
I think you should revert that question to the chaplain.
I can only speak on behalf of the chaplaincy, not of the church. But with regards to the survey, I've been trying to read through it and to see what are the main core issues that need to be addressed. And one of the facts that has struck me is that when we looked at the major tenets of faith, we seem to be in great decline. However, we cannot, or at least I wouldn't like to go out and present that as an issue. I'm trying to work with creating new activities, new encounters where we can meet the students, see where they are through the survey and exactly at this present moment, and then start a journey with them where they find themselves. So it's working through friendship, reaching out, meeting the individuals and then journeying with them according to their needs. One of the main tasks this year would be using or offering the Q&A, which is a question and answer evening, precisely to bring out themes that have emerged and address them as a forum where they can address their issues and maybe receive some answers. But I think we still have a lot to learn from the students, because we need to listen before we act. And I think chaplaincy's approach would be, let us spend some time listening to our students and staff and then taking an approach from there. But certainly the Q&A is one of the few forums which will address certain issues. In fact, I can make some propaganda for our next one next week on the 28th, which will be dealing with Islam. We have the Imam coming over, and the topic will be, what is the impact of Islam on our culture? Because I think we need to start becoming educated. Before, we saw the system there where if we accept a faith but no knowledge, it's going to fizzle out. We need to have an informed faith so that what we believe in can truly be shared with others without imposing it. But we can at least give witness of what we believe in by our actions, by our words, by being with others and welcoming them. So chaplaincy is looking into the survey slowly, and seeing what the needs of our students are as we go along. Because the times are changing, and we need to be addressing these moments.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Any other questions? Yes, Professor Lowry.
Hello. Two comments about the Maltese data. First, the qualitative aspect. This questionnaire had a bit of qualitative element because there were some open-ended questions, not deep in their views, but some open-ended questions. And we did analyze them in the paper we wrote with Durier. In fact, we analyzed their responses with respect to the group, one of the four groups they belonged in. And I agree with you that basically it confirms the belief typology they are in. Secondly, I've been looking at this data now a bit more empirically, because like you, I'm a bit an empiricist. And I wonder if you've had an experience like this. There were other questions dealing with beliefs and dogmas, with sexual morality and with participation in sacraments and church practices. And I tried to check whether these factors can predict the membership in one of the four quadrants. And the most difficult one to pin down is the literal disaffirmation. So basically, in our sample, if you know what the respondent has answered on the other factors, you've got a more than 50% chance of guessing what in what quadrant he is, except for the literal disaffirmation. They seem to be, you know, really difficult to pin down. I wonder if you've had this sort of experience in other cultures, or if it is unique to our sample.
I don't know if I grasped the real question specifically.
Whether it's possible from those divergences mentioned, like, for instance, the difference between belief and sexual morality.
Yes, because the students were asked, apart from the scale, were asked other questions. Mm-hmm. So you can try and see if the answers to some other questions help you to categorize in those four groups. And the literal disaffirmation group just wouldn't be pinned down. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult, knowing what their responses are, to get them there.
Yeah.
Disaffirmation, which one would it be?
Now? The external critique, you mean?
External critique.
Yes.
That's difficult.
Yes, that's the difficult one. That's what we found.
Yeah, of course.
Yes.
They give the impression that they are absolutely indifferent. That's out of their mind, out of their field of interest. I'm not so sure of that. On this moment, it can be true. That's outer difference, and that, in fact, on that reason, it's difficult to put them somewhere. But I think if they are confronted in their personal life with some element, it will become important. So it's because of the fact, I think, that on the moment it's a little bit out of their life experience. But I'm rather sure that was one of my basic discussions with Vergoten 25 years ago, that in fact nobody is really indifferent. It's always touched you. If it's belonging, or it comes into your personal life. On the moment, if everything goes well, okay, there's no problem. But if there is a problem coming up, I'm sure that in fact they will switch, they will change, they will struggle with the question. But I agree with you, on the moment, if everything goes well, live and let live. Why make a problem? You see? That was one of when I was much younger, that was one of my points. I thought there was a real religious indifference, that this group was growing up. Vergoten was always from the meaning that it doesn't exist, and I think he's right. But it has to belong to your personal experience. If it's outside your personal world on this moment, of course, nothing is going on. But if it's coming into your life, it becomes important. For example, I think always, for example, people living outside religious institution, let's say as indifferent or unbelievers, the moment they have a personal event in their personal life, for example, a child is dying in a car accident, the religious question is asked. Why does God allow this? And of course, they perhaps will give a non-religious answer, because they have a kind of idea that God is some paramagician working out and giving you a punishment. Check. On that moment, you see, it's still working. So in that sense, I think if it's related to your personal life, it will become important. Perhaps negatively important. I don't say automatically positive, negatively, but it will become important. They will ask the religious question, I think.
Yes, this is a good case. The studies that are being conducted in Germany now, which Drive and Hood, about deconversion. They have found it very difficult to define that. Deconverting from what? Deconverting. That's the term which is being used. So it seems that religion is like energy. It cannot be destroyed. It just changes from one form to another.
Take a last question.
Yeah, thanks. I seem to be attracted by uncertainties more than by certainties. And in what you said, there were two things that that struck me, and I'd like to ask you some further questions about. The first one is what you said about relativism.
About?
Relativism. Which I think is of course quite a crucial issue, because it pretty much characterizes all that doesn't fall into the strict category of orthodoxy. I would tend to agree with you that relativism can be seen, in the first instance at least, as a temporary period. And obviously many people get stuck in there. Now, what I would be interested in knowing would be, to what extent can the social cultural background you described, particularly with regards to how religious belief is presented, very often as requirements, to contribute to people remaining or extending that that period of relativism? Because even the any survey, and including this survey, does in some way, in this case I don't think very rigidly, which is good, but does in some way present a picture of what, for example, it is to be Catholic and how a Catholic should behave. And the response will always be related to that picture. Now, in the case of the respondents in Malta, there's obviously a very strong framework within which those questions are answered. And that has very much to do with what you said about being given just one answer. So my hunch is that many people feel that they do not belong or do not fully belong because they do not fully concur or fit in that model. And perhaps the problem might be more with the model that is being presented rather than with the responses. I'm not sure, and this is not really regarding interpretation of statistics itself, but just a further reflection to continue this discussion. Would any change in, not in doctrine or in teachings, but a change in approach, relating even to the question of what the chaplaincy or the church can do, of language mainly, would that bring about any change in responses? Because you mentioned one very interesting example, and that's what triggered it off. You mentioned what happened after Humanae Vitae, but I think by and large, the reasons why many people, or some of the main reasons why many people today just move away from belonging to religion are very much the same reasons why those couples, the young couples you mentioned before, for example, moved away after Humanae Vitae. The difference is, of course, that today parts, and it's always the same parts of Humanae Vitae that are quoted or seen as controversial, are still presented in a perhaps in an even stronger way at the exclusion of other elements of what Christian life means, which also didn't feature in the survey.
It was a long question. No. I focus a little bit on the change of language. I don't know if I understand you very well that, let's say, the speaking of the church had to use so-called modern or perhaps post-modern language. So another language than what we could call the traditional religious language. I don't think so. I don't think that you had to translate the gospel into a modern language. I don't think so. Because we had experience a little bit, they tried that in the 60s and 70s with us, and in fact, so-called modern religious language becomes very easily a very flat language without dimensionalities. So I think, but that's one element of my answer. The second element is I think that it's, of course, very important that we train people, and that's a real training, an exercise, to understand on a symbolic level what means symbolic. Because the danger is that symbolic could mean, oh, it's only symbolic, nothing more than that. And there is no reality behind that. That, I think, is a false meaning of symbolic language. What I mean is to try to understand, to interpret what kind of text, at best the original text, not a translated text, because a translated text is still an interpretation. You don't translate in all kinds of directions, you translate in a specific direction. So translating, making modern, I mean, is still an interpretation. And I would prefer that the interpretation is made into the mind of the people, so that we train people to interpret. Like I said, the story of the Gospel Mark, in Mark, Jesus walked on the water. I think it's interesting to confront people with that original text and ask them what is that bringing up in your mind before translating that in so-called modern language. So that's a little bit my response. The second element is, of course, and I make myself free, if you are using the Glockenstark items with, let's say, your religious content, your belief statements, you can say the heaven and the angels, etc. That's for me a very difficult question. Let's say, and that's a theological question, so I'm free of answer. What's in fact the minimum to be good that you can be considered as a believer? That's a theological question, and I know in theology there are many discussions about that. So what's the minimum that you had to answer, yes, to make it simple, in order to be a believer? So I think there could be a discussion that to focus on, let's say, what the Catholic theology is giving as important points and try to make understandable what people feel and think and which kind of emotions, etc., have, so that it can become something also for them. On the moment, it could be very distant, very far away, but it has to do with them in function of similar emotions, similar feelings, similar thoughts we have about it. The example I've given about the desert is, I think, a very good example. I don't know if it's an answer. Okay.
Okay. I would like to thank Professor Hutzebot for his excellent presentation, and also Father Paul Gallia, both for the presentation, and to both of them for answering so clearly the questions raised from the floor. I would like to thank the Honorable Clyde Pooley, Parliament Secretary in the Ministry of Education and Youth and Sport, for having joined us during the latter part of this seminar. What is for sure is we've seen that there's a wealth of information in this survey, and we hope that, as we said in the beginning, the results which came out from the survey would be used by all stakeholders, people who
work and pastoral work amongst youths outside the university, because if we accept that these are a reflection of what is happening or what is prevalent in our society, there's a lot to work on and there's a lot for us to think about if we want to influence the future of our community and the way we look both at religion and about spirituality. Thank you very much for joining us, and I hope that you found the seminar interesting and beneficial to you. Thank you.
You have just listened to a talk organized by the University Chaplaincy entitled Religious Beliefs and Attitudes of Maltese University Students. This talk was delivered by Professor Dirk Hutzbout.